to the Parentpreneur Accelerator podcast, helping you build the business of your dreams while having time with the family you love. Here is your host, Cyril, the entrepreneur and proud dad, Alexis Kingsbury.
Thank you very much for your help, Ethan.
Hi there, it's Alexis here, and in this week's episode, I'm interviewing Lucy Parsons. Lucy is the CEO of Life More Extraordinary and is an academic coach who supports teenagers and their parents through GCSE and A-level exams, teaching them the study skills that they need to reach their full academic potential. At the age of 9, Lucy decided that she would like to study at Cambridge University, and she went to comprehensive schools where there wasn't much help in or expertise in helping students achieve things like this, so she worked it out on her own. And after her 3 years at Cambridge, she was headhunted for her first job with Tesco, but found that corporate life wasn't for her. So she then trained as a teacher and worked in schools for 4 years. Her business was then born out of the desire to continue to work in education, but to be at home for her young family, and I believe that she hasn't looked back since. She's now the author, become the author of the 10-step guide to acing every exam you ever take, and she is the founder of the Extraordinaries Club, an online membership site for families to support them through the exam years. Lucy has been featured for her knowledge in The Telegraph, The Independent, and on BBC Radio 5 Live and other places too. So in this episode, we're going to be discussing how Lucy supports teens and parents through the exam years and get some advice for those of us that are either in it right now or just have it on the horizon, as I do. We'll also talk about how Lucy originally wrote and launched her book and how this led to her getting a publishing contract and also how all of that related to the expansion of her business. And we'll explore how her business enables her to work in a flexible way around her health needs and her family and the importance of her well-being journey. Lucy, thanks so much for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Cool. Well, let's start off with that, how the business was started part of the story, because I mentioned there that you trained as a teacher, worked in schools, and then created the business when you wanted to be at home with your young family. So what stage were the kids at that? Were they born yet? Was it a few years in? And how did all that play out?
Okay, so yeah, the children were little when the business started. So I think my daughter was in reception. Yeah, she was. And my son would have been 2 at the time. Yeah. So I think he just started at preschool. And she was in reception. So it really started because I kind of got into the online world or discovered it through having a bit of an Etsy shop, actually, when my children were really little. And I was listening to an online training about creating digital products to try and kind of, you know, scale a little bit on the shop. And the woman who was doing this training said, you should create something that is about what you do better than anyone else in the world, or, you know, what most people see you as being best at. And I kind of sat there and I thought, well, the thing that I'm best at is actually taking exams. And the next morning I was doing the washing up after breakfast, you know, in that kind of manic rush that you have getting small children out of the house in the morning. And I suddenly had this idea. I was like, I need to write a book. I need to write a book about how I managed to get 5 A's in my A-levels and the study system that I created to make that happen. So you said in your intro that I went to comprehensive schools and there wasn't an awful lot of support and help. So yeah, I basically had to work it out on my own, and I created this study system. And then through my teaching career, I managed to refine that study system. So by the time I got the children to school, you know, in all the manic rush, you know, putting the coats on, making sure they got the bags, cleaning their teeth, all that kind of stuff, by the time I was home, I had a title for the book in my head and a chapter outline. And I came into the house, sat down at the computer, had 3 hours till I had to pick my son up from preschool, and I'd written 2 chapters by the time I went to fetch him. Wow. So it took me 8 days to write that first version of the book. I was just like on a roll. So I wrote the book, and then I thought, I'm going to publish this as a PDF. So basically I abandoned the Etsy shop, and I set up a website. I found a graphic designer to turn the book into a PDF. It was about 14,000 words at this stage. Mm-hmm. And so I set up the website, wrote a few blog posts, ran a few Facebook ads, and got the book out there within about a month. So that was the beginning of the business.
And when you say got the book out there within a month as a PDF?
As a PDF, yeah. At that stage. So it existed as a PDF for about a year, I would guess. And in that time, you know, I was making connections and things online, and I met this lovely person. She's become a true friend. And she went off to TEDx Norwich, which is a TEDx event that is focused on education. And there she met the managing director of an educational publishing company. And he said to her, do you want to write a book? And she said, I don't, but my friend Lucy does. Here's her website details. So he went home that evening, looked at my website. I was giving away a free chapter of the book as a kind of lead magnet to try and encourage people to buy it. He downloaded that, read it, and the next morning emailed me and said, can we publish your book? So it was a rather amazing, you know, it was a coincidence, but it was all about, you know, putting myself out there and doing what I could with what I had at that point in time. So I had very, very little money to launch. You know, the whole launch of the business probably cost me £500 or less, including setting up the website, paying for the graphic designer, paying for some Facebook ads to develop a little bit of an email list and an audience. So, and, you know, it was a bit of a gamble that I'd taken, but I'd put it out there in a form that I was able to do that. And by doing that, that's how the publisher found me. So I wasn't kind of sitting in my house thinking, oh, I've got this idea for a book, but, nice. You know, I haven't got a publisher. And so it all kind of snowballed from there, really.
That's awesome. And before we follow that snowboard down the hill and explore exactly what happened, like, I want to catch a few things there, because I think that's fantastic. I love the fact that it all started with that sort of 8 days of getting frenetically excited about this writing, and then realizing, actually, rather than go through the headache and the pain and the cost of trying to do it as a book, because actually, you know, this story could have been different. You could have ended up spending your life savings on, yeah, on publishing a book that doesn't go anywhere, and unfortunately that's a not uncommon story. But instead you did the far more sensible thing of actually doing a little test and getting it out there. Now, just before we go on to what did happen, as a bit of a thought experiment, like, if you hadn't had that connection later down the line, or even if, let's say, that contact had looked at the website and said, oh no, actually, you know, don't like Lucy's writing, or, you know, or it's just not the right fit or whatever, like, what would you have been your total to that point, like, total downside in terms of cost and time and whatever? How painful would that have been by that stage if it had then gone nowhere at all from that point?
Well, I mean, it didn't cost me so much. It made me money, you know, not very much. I think when I finally took the PDF down from sale, yeah, I made, you know, about just over £1,000, and I was selling it for £10 a copy. So I'd made money on the costs of putting that product together. And I'd also got private coaching clients in the meantime from the blogging activity and the fact that the book was out there. And, you know, my first coaching client, she bought the book and then became a client after that. So I didn't lose anything as a result of doing that. It was just a proof of concept. You know, I thought you were going somewhere like, what would you have done if the publisher hadn't found you? I did talk to a book coach at one point. She wanted £5,000 to help me write the book. And I think, I was only thinking yesterday, actually, that would have been a terrible mistake if I'd paid that money to work with her, because, you know, it's really difficult to get decent amounts of money back on a book. You know, a book isn't a way to directly make money, and that's what I've found through my journey. So I don't know if you want me to carry on down that road.
Yeah, definitely, because one of the reasons I sort of underline and ask about the potential downside and so on is because I know there are lots of parentpreneurs out there who feel like they've got a book in them, and some, you know, some want it as a business, some don't want it as a business, but they kind of feel like, oh yeah, I'd love to do a book at some stage. And unfortunately, many go down the route of, as you say, you know, $5,000 on the book coach, or they just spend a lot of time on it and then they're disappointed when they don't get the results and so on. And I think, and one of the other things is that for those that do want the money from it, I think setting an expectation of, you don't make money from the book. You know, there are rare exceptions, you know, sort of the J.K. Rowling kind of examples, but actually most people don't make money from the book. And that's kind of why I was kind of asking about, you know, for you, what had happened. I love the fact that you highlight, well, actually, yes, you did sell the PDF and that covered costs of, you know, the £500 of getting it all set up and then the website and then your time of kind of managing it or whatever, but it's still not providing an income. But then the coaching off the side does. So I think, I'd love to hear then in terms of on the book deal and what happened there and your recommendations around that, because I think it's definitely relevant to people.
Yeah, so when he wrote and offered me this book deal, he wrote and offered it to me, and then I made a contact in a Facebook group who was a kind of an advisor on book deals and that kind of thing, and she really helped me to get a really good deal out of the contract. I mean, I was chatting to a friend yesterday who got a deal with Bloomsbury, and it has, you know, blows mine out of the water, but, you know, for a small niche educational publisher, it was a good deal. I managed to get an advance, which they weren't initially offering, and I've got decent royalties for the industry. And I said I couldn't start writing until the children went back to school after the summer holidays. So literally my son started school and I came home, and he was doing half days still. And he did half days for 6 weeks. I came home the day he started school and I started on the first chapter. And so the publisher wanted me to rewrite it. They wanted me to double the length to 30,000 words. So I sat down that morning and I created this plan. I was like, I'm going to finish this book in 6 weeks by half term. So for the first, I worked out, I've got 10 chapters. I can spend 3 days on each chapter to get it done in kind of 4 weeks, and then 2 weeks of editing and proofing and all that. And then I can hand it over to the publisher. So literally I would drop them at school, and I live about 5 minutes from the school. I would come home, I would shut the back door behind me, I would walk straight to my desk, I would sit down and I would write for an hour minimum. And, you know, I would hit my word count every single day, and just got it done. And I wrote the 30,000 words in 18 days. And then I had 2 weeks to proof it. And then I handed it over to the publisher at half term. And then I spent the next half term. So my life works in half term. Children. And I work in education. But I spent the next half term building my audience. So I started a Facebook group. I took an Instagram course. You know, I was focused on building my email list. And I did a lot of outreach to publications that were relevant to my audience, so that I was starting to put in place opportunities for PR, basically, to write articles and all that kind of thing for when the book came out. So the book was published on the 14th of February 2017, Valentine's Day, and it went brilliantly. But the key thing in getting it to go so well was that I managed to get an article in the Daily Telegraph. And the day that happened, it actually went out in January, and late January, but the book was already on Amazon for pre-orders. And the day that that article went out, like literally, the orders went through the roof, and the book, you know, on Amazon rankings got to the 106th bestseller on Amazon out of all the book, like millions of books on Amazon. And, you know, it was beating all sorts of celebrity books very, very, very temporarily. But it was an amazing feeling that, you know, getting that one really crucial piece of press coverage had made such a difference. And then from there, because it was placed in the Telegraph and all these people saw about it and all these people ordered it and bought it, I then started getting loads more inquiries about coaching. And so after that February half term, I was fully booked with coaching clients for the very, very first time. And that was because of the publicity I was able to generate because of the book. So I would never have got that publicity if I hadn't had a book published.
Yeah, I think that's, I love how you link those chain of events, because it's so important, because I think Often, I think people starting businesses or in businesses, they're often looking for individual tactics. You know, what's the thing on Facebook that works really well? Or, you know, how do I get a piece of PR? And I think what you illustrate beautifully there is, like, actually, it's about the order is possibly more important than the individual tactics. Because I love the fact that when earlier when I asked a question about sort of potential downside, and you said, I thought you were going to ask, what would I have done if I hadn't have got that deal? And of course, the answer is, you'd have found a different way. You know, you'd have kept on going and found, and the only way in which you'd have probably stopped is if you had spoke to a load of publishers and indeed potential customers, and that they had said no, or indeed that the PDF hadn't sold at all, and therefore and there was no interest in, you couldn't give it away. Like, the point there is that there are lots of different ways in which you could do it, you know, if not the Telegraph, then somewhere else. But the important bit was the order. The fact that by having the PDF meant that you're able to get the book deal. By having the book deal, you're able then to put the focus and the time into actually doing a really good job of it. By then having done a good job of it and having it available, it meant that when the piece of PR came in, that you're able to then capitalize that and turn that into book sales. But then also having already tested out the concept of book, people buy book and then want coaching, meant that you'd also got that all set up, which meant that was then able to fill your roster. So that you were able to turn this idea that you had one morning, you know, do the washing up or whatever, into this business that is, you know, booked up and generating an income. And I think that's really important. I'm so glad you kind of shared it and with that clarity of those are the steps that need to be in place. So
I think the other thing I should say there is, you know, that morning when I had that idea while I was doing the washing up, that was in March 2015. Mm. Okay. And then the book was published in February 2017. So it was a 23-month period for that to happen.
Yeah, and I love that as a point, because essentially what you're getting at there is, I think often we as entrepreneurs think of these kind of things as, we want everything now, we want the results really quickly. We kind of expect that, you know, we'll start something and in a year from now we'll decide whether or not it's been successful. And actually what you're highlighting there is actually 2 years up to the book being available, but then you probably need another 6 months before you can then say, oh yes, and I've now got decent sales and all of that coming in, right?
So
it's sort of 2 to 3 years is the expectation around how to make that work. Which brings me to the question of, okay, so if it took 2 to 3 years before that sort of thing works, and you did have some income along the way, but I'm assuming it wasn't the primary source of income. So how did you support being able to do that for that period? And not have to give it all up and go get a full-time job back at Tesco, perhaps not in their corporate head office, but stacking shelves.
I was in a very lucky position that, you know, we decided after my first child was born that we would move away from where my teaching job was. So we moved 100 miles north, back to nearer both sets of our parents, and that I wouldn't go back to work. So I was basically faffing about with the Etsy shop and tinkering around on the side, more for my own well-being and interest than to make a living. And, you know, my husband has been going out every day and he earns well. So, you know, I've been in quite a privileged position in that way. If I hadn't been in that position, then no, I couldn't have waited the 2 years. So, yeah. And I think the other thing to say is that I had a very steep learning curve an awful lot to learn about business. And I probably could have made money sooner if I'd known more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to go on these journeys for a reason, don't you? And, you know, I've gained so much knowledge and wisdom and understanding as a result of that journey. And I can't regret that. It's part of what's made me who I am and what the business is today.
Yeah, no, I think that's fantastic. And okay, I think sharing the how you were able to support it and the decisions that led to you, you know, being from home and so on, that meant that you then had the time available, that I think is important. And I know that there are some in that position, some not in that position. Out of interest, like, for when you were making the decision around deciding not to return to work, like, because presumably before that point you had dual income, and you know, and then you're kind of looking at, okay, so we're going to drop the income down. Like, how hard a decision was that? Because as as great an earner as your partner may be, I suspect that they didn't rock up to the manager, their boss, and say, "I'd like a pay rise from which you double my salary, please."
No.
Post tax.
As a teacher, I earn okay, but not stellar amounts of money. My husband had nearly always earned more than me. I earned slightly more when we first met and I was working at Tesco, but you know, him in the corporate world has always earned considerably more than I have. So my experience of pregnancy, my first pregnancy, I had to have a lot of time off work. I wasn't terribly well even when I went back to work. I was doing part-time hours, and then when my daughter was born, the birth was a pretty horrendous experience, and then I got an infection which didn't heal for 11 weeks and that kind of thing. And it just kind of put life in a very different perspective. And I think we were living 100 miles away from my parents and a three-hour drive away from his parents, and we were calling a lot on family for support at that time. And it just became very, and I the other thing that I would say is that teaching had been such a struggle for me. My husband, despite being the higher wage earner, had done all the supermarket shopping, all the cooking, while I sat and marked books in the evenings. And I would, you know, every Monday get a migraine because I teach five straight lessons with the worst behaved kids of the week on a Monday afternoon. And then you'd have a meeting in the straight after school, and then I'd have to come home and mark books because I had my two most important exam classes on consecutive days on Monday and Tuesday. And so by the end of Monday, I always had a migraine and I was rung out, and I just knew I couldn't be the teacher that the school expected me to be and that I wanted to be, and at the same time be the mother that I wanted to be. So all of those things combined made it very, very clear that it really wasn't a goer to A, be a full-time teacher, and B, to remain living where we were. So we made that decision to move. And because we moved north, we were living in Berkshire, and we moved back up to Northamptonshire, house prices were a lot lower. So we managed to get a bigger house for the same mortgage. So we didn't increase our mortgage when we moved. And we just decided to live a lot leaner lifestyle. So, you know, I had very little disposable income through all of this period. Like my husband gave me £100 a month for everything that I wanted to, and I invested most of that in my businesses, so I didn't buy any new clothes and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was a very, very conscious decision about what we wanted out of life, and, you know, spending the resources we had on the things that were important to us.
Yeah, I love that. I think I'm so glad I asked the question, and thank you so much for kind of sharing the detail of that, because I think that's really useful for couples out there to kind of be thinking about sometimes making those hard decisions about, you know, looking at what really matters, and actually being open to problem solving on how you can achieve that life, and particularly to support some of the family and the well-being objectives that you had, which brings me on to that kind of how does it work now? Like, to what extent do you feel like your sort of new career and the business that you have and the work that you do, to what extent does that provide you the flexibility and the setup to support your health needs, your well-being, and that of your family? Like, how much has that changed? How have you managed to make sure, you know, have you made it sure that it does work for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I know, like, my biggest priority is the family, really, but coming a very close second is my personal ambition and drive, which I've always had, you know, when I was at school, to get top grades and into Cambridge and all that. And, you know, I found when I tried to be a stay-at-home mum that just wasn't enough for me. So I think it's part of my well-being to have this business and, you know, to achieve something and contribute to the world. So those things marry very well together, because I work from home, and, you know, the children are 8 and 6 now, but when they were a little bit younger, you know, I used to take them to school, I'd come home and work on the business, and then I'd pick them up from school and we'd do the clubs and societies or whatever they were doing. I'd cook them their tea, me and my husband would put them to bed together, and then I'd do my coaching calls in the evening. Now, last year I found I was doing too much of that and I was really burnt out by the end of the school year. And I've changed the business model a bit for this academic year. And because the children are getting older and they need me a bit more in the evenings, you know, the bedtime's getting slightly later and all that kind of thing. But I've always very, very consciously structured the business around their needs. And, you know, it's about, you know, if the school says come in and hear about what they're going to be doing this year at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, I can be there and I can do that. And I think that's even more important to me because I'm in the education business and I've been a teacher and I've worked with a lot of parents as well as students. And I see how important it is for parents to be involved, really hands on in their children's education. And so it all kind of comes together. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It does. And I think I definitely identify with that. And I think lots of other preppreneurs that I've interviewed and been in my accelerated program, would you know, that would chime with them because it's, as you say, it's not just a case of, oh, well, work is negative to well-being and not working is positive to well-being. It's actually like that work and using your brain and feeling sense of achievement and contribution and social contact and all those sorts of things, they're actually really important as part of your well-being and so it's part of it. But I think, as you say, like the flexibility that you've got in a completely different way to what you had before makes a big difference. So that's really cool. And in terms of are there any areas where you have found it more of a challenge over the last few years that maybe you weren't expecting or just things that you've had to overcome with the you know, completely different setup of having a business rather than a job or not a job?
Do you mean like with the family?
Yeah.
I don't think so because teaching is such a rigid thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, like when I was pregnant and having to take time off work, I constantly felt guilty because I was letting down, you know, so many students and other teachers because other teachers were having to cover the fact that I was absent. And then even just having a doctor's appointment, you know, you'd ring up the doctor's surgery and they'd be like, well, you can come in at this time. You're like, well, have you got a time that's in my free period so that I don't have to get cover, yeah. somebody else, you know, all that kind of thing. Teaching, you know, people think it's a really family friendly job. It really isn't.
Yeah, only during the holiday times, I guess, because it's during their working times. It's, yeah.
Even during the holidays, you've often got work to do and then you haven't got any childcare because your children are at home with you. So, and, you know, parents' evenings and all that kind of thing. It's really, really tough, really tough. And while building a business is tough, it's tough in a very different way. I think it's tough mentally and it really pushes you in a personal development kind of way. But teaching is physically tough. And yeah, I wouldn't swap it now.
was that quite weird for you going from corporate life into teaching and then finding that corporate life was easier?
Well, yeah, so corporate life was easier in some ways, but I was bored in the corporate world and that it didn't align with my values. And I just the pace of the teaching and educational environment is really exciting and really keeps you on your toes and you're always learning. You're always talking to somebody new because, you know, you might see 150 children every single day and that kind of thing. And that I just find, and when I talk to my husband about his corporate job now as well, it's just like the corporate world moves so slowly.
Yeah.
It's so infuriating. And they ponder about decisions and there's all this politicking and all that kind of stuff. And you just think, no, I'm better on my own. Just push on through and do it myself.
Amazing. I love that. Awesome. Well, let's move on perhaps to some of the more advice around your subject matter expertise, as it were. So because at the moment, you support an audience of both parents, students and teachers, and that must be an interesting time for you. And predominantly on this podcast, our audience will be parents. So what would you say are some of the kind of top piece of advice that you'd have? Or perhaps we should start with what are some of the top concerns and issues that you've tended to see that parents have relating to these to the exam years? Because I think it'd be really useful for those parents that are either in it or, you know, have got children young enough to not yet be in it, but it will come to kind of understand that.
Okay, well, there's two key things and then a few other smaller things. So the biggest reason why parents come to me and want my advice is because schools don't tend to teach their children, their students, how to revise. So actually how to study in a productive and useful way. So they come to me to answer that question, how do you revise? So that's what I teach them. The other thing that I see parents really struggling with is things like distractions and concentration and work ethic. And this is because a lot of the time in the first 3 years of secondary school, the schools don't really push their students, and they don't, and this is by no means all schools, but it's quite a wide experience, that they kind of, you know, primary school, they keep them learning and they keep them focused and they set regular homework and all this kind of thing. And when they go to secondary school, it all just kind of fizzles a bit. And then they get into year 10 and it's like suddenly the pressure goes up and the expectations go up. And these kids who've kind of got used to quite an easy life outside school are suddenly expected to do a whole lot more. And it's really tough for the parents, and they find themselves nagging and stressing and all that kind of thing. And it becoming a real sticking point in family life. So I found myself actually also helping with those kind of relationships and how to communicate within the family. So I think if I'm thinking about families and, you know, how do you get to year 10 without, you know, having this big kind of blow up and argument and all that kind of thing, I think it's really about consistency and setting really consistent expectations with your children about, you know, completing homework to a decent standard. And if homework isn't set, then what are you going to do instead? So maybe you subscribe to a good quality educational magazine. Like my daughter reads one called Aquila, which is like a very general knowledge kind of magazine. There's another one called The Week Junior. Or are they going to read a book? Or are they going to work on their project? Like if they like fiddling about with wood or Lego or something like that, you know, what are they going to do that's productive rather than just kind of going on Snapchat or Netflix or whatever it is and forming bad habits around those things that are majorly distracting and addictive? So I think it's about setting really clear expectations about what actually happens at home to support their education. I think it's about parents showing that they have a strong interest in education as well. So talking to their children about what they're learning at school, talking about the books that they're reading, taking them to museums, galleries, exhibitions and all that kind of thing, and just attending parents' evenings, all that kind of stuff, so that your children are being shown on a daily and weekly basis that you're invested in their education, so they're not trying to sweep it under the carpet or get away with things, if you know what I mean. And then I think if you address that, then you're going to address a lot of the issues that typically come up in the early stages of the exam years. I think the other thing with revision is just teaching them to revise. I mean, I've got a blog post on my website, which I can share with you if you want to add it to the show notes or whatever. And it's about how to revise in years 7, 8 and 9, and just introducing some of these simple techniques, but also talking to your children. You know, if they've got a spelling test, you know, what works for them in terms of learning their spellings, and starting getting them to think about how their brain works and what works for them. So most people have heard of different learning styles like kinesthetic, auditory and visual, which have actually been discredited by neuroscientists, but it's a helpful way to us to start thinking about almost like our learning personality and what helps us to learn effectively, and the techniques that are involved in us learning effectively. So like if you take the example of spelling tests, then, you know, is it repetition? Is it writing it out? Is it spelling it out? Is it saying it out loud? Is it, you know, just talking to them about what it is that's working and what doesn't work for them, then they will start to develop a stronger sense of what works for their brain and start to take ownership of how they learn independently. Because I think that's what so many students struggle with, is that they suddenly get to needing to revise for exams and they just have no idea how to learn independently, either in terms of the techniques or how to kind of regulate their own learning and discipline themselves and all that kind of stuff.
That's really interesting. I love that. And I completely identify with that. It's funny when you're talking about the different ways in which you learn and remember and so on, and developing that, because I was recently covering some learning that my son has got, and he's only in reception year, but he's very proud of what he's learnt in terms of his letters and his numbers and shapes, and he's asking me what a 100-sided shape was the other day, which is quite an interesting challenge. And so I've had to learn the formula for how you work it out. Going through all that and realising that actually I can remember there are certain parts of my own education where there are gaps, and actually... if I think about it, it's often because they're not during that period. I didn't know or take advantage of the best way in which I learn. So I know that I'm a very visual learner. Therefore, whenever I did revision, I did mind maps of things, and then it's like my brain takes a photo of it, and I can then remember the picture of the mind map, and then can recall most of the stuff on it. Whereas, yeah. For example, when I learned times tables, I was taught it or attempted to be taught it via sort of repetition and hearing it, which doesn't work at all for my brain. And so as a result, to this day, I struggle with 6, 7, 8 times tables. Yes. Despite the fact getting A's in maths at later years, it's like, yeah, I can, as if you give me a calculator, that's fine. I think that's, I share that slightly embarrassing story, because I think it's useful for us to remember as parents that we do learn in different ways, and we've got our own experiences of those problems and whatever. And I think, as you say, like early on starting to develop that ability to in the child that they understand how they learn best is a really powerful way of doing that. And I'll certainly make sure that I've got a link to that blog post in the show notes for more information on that. So thank you Lucy. So we've covered quite a few different areas there around some of the challenges that parents have and that the children have relating to exams and revision, and some of the sort of top tips that you've got. And I'll make sure that we link to your book as well in the show notes. Any other kind of top piece of advice that you'd have for parents that are fretting about it, or that, are having those kind of challenges?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I kind of wish I could say more often, really, is that it's going to be okay. I went to see, I don't know if you know, Simon Reeve, who does the documentaries on TV where he does travel logs around interesting parts of the world.
Yeah.
But I went to see him speak at the theatre. He's promoting his autobiography. And he left school without any qualifications at all. And he managed to get a job in the post room of the Sunday Times. And from there, managed to become an investigative journalist, and then wrote a book about Al-Qaeda before anybody'd ever heard of them, and was the only expert when 9/11 happened. And then from there became, started doing his TV programs. And I think exams are important, and for a particular type of students, they're a bit like me, they're particularly important, but they are not make or break for your child and their life. So just try not to lose too much sleep over it. I think why I've got so into exams is because it's a huge personal development experience, I think, for students to learn about themselves, to learn about their own personalities, and to kind of push themselves to see what they can achieve. And I think if you look at it like that, like a bit like training for a marathon or something like that, that you're doing this to find out what you can do and find out what you can achieve, rather than to prove yourself or test yourself in some way. I think it's a much healthier mindset, and remembering that life, most of these kids are going to live till they're nearly 100, if not over 100. And life, that it's not a make or break when they're 16 years old. So, yeah, I want them to do well, and it's easier in a lot of ways if they do well. But just try to calm down a little bit.
Yeah. I love that advice, and I particularly like the analogy there of the marathon, because I guess to extend that analogy, it wouldn't be right to say, like, when you say the training for a marathon, doing the marathon, the health and fitness of the child at their age of 100 will have very little to do with whether or not they did a marathon.
Yeah.
However, the attitudes and the approaches and the self-learning and development of getting to a point where you can run for a marathon, and indeed do well in one, and do so in a way that doesn't mean you have a heart attack at the end of it and all that kind of stuff, that is what would be a huge determining factor in the 100-year health of that individual.
Yeah, and it's really what I try to do now is, you know, in my membership club, is I'm really teaching self-development through the lens of getting better at studying for exams. And so it's kind of a roundabout way of teaching these students to be better people. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about it.
I love that. That is such a cool way of looking at it. And I think quite empowering as well for parents that, as you say, like, because it's one thing to say, oh, don't worry about it too much, it's not make or break. Because that can, you know, because the problem with that is it can feel a little bit like, you know, oh, you know, don't worry. It's like, yeah, but I am worried.
It can feel dismissive, yeah.
Yeah, whereas I think what you have actually said is very empowering, because it's about saying, don't worry about the outcome, concentrate on the process. You know, yeah. The same way as when we talk about building a business, you know, we say, don't fixate too much on the, oh, one day I'm going to be a millionaire with a yacht and an island, because... One, you will be unhappy for a lot of time until you reach that goal. Two, you may never reach that goal. And three, if you do reach that goal, you may not be happy with how it makes you feel. And so I think, enjoying the process is a more effective way of looking at exams, because A, you may do everything right and still the exams come out not how the child wants, perhaps because of expectations or whatever. But two, even if they do come out well, it actually doesn't have that much bearing. As you say, you know, both sides of the coin are true with make or break. You know, it's like in my degree study, I happened to scratch A first. I can tell you it has made zero difference to my life. And I basically closed my businesses in my final year of study so that I could get that first. And occasionally wonder what would have happened if actually I hadn't closed my businesses and focusing my time on that instead.
Better off, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and so I think, so as a result, the lesson there is not don't worry about exams at all. Instead, all start businesses. But instead, it's concentrate on the journey and the process of learning so that the value you get from exams can be pulled out.
One of my clients' parents said to me, I worked with her through the last 6 months of her A-level courses last year, and she said she's learned to be mentally strong as a result of working with you. And to me, that's a much greater testimonial than, you know, whatever the grades that she got, and that's going to live with her for the rest of her life.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, that's probably a good place for us to end there, Lucy. It's been so good talking to you. It's been such amazing advice there. Really, really enjoyed the covering the story of how you built your business and what you're doing. Before we close, I mentioned there's. I'll make sure we link to the blog and the book and so on. How else can people find out about what you're doing and the amazing support that you provide?
Okay, the best place to come is to my website, which is lifemoreextraordinary.com, or I have a Facebook group which is exclusively for parents, and it's called the Supportive Parents Successful Students Community on Facebook.
Fantastic, and I'll make sure that is included as well. Brilliant. Well, it's been thank you so much for your time today. It really has been awesome talking to you, and I wish you best of luck for the future. But thank you very much for your time and for the invaluable support that you're providing for the next generation. Thanks very much, Lucy.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and have taken away some ideas that you can put into practice. You can find the links to any resources mentioned in this episode over on the show notes at parentpreneur.com/podcast. If you found this podcast useful, then please review it on iTunes. 5-star review ratings would absolutely make my day. Also, please join the conversation on this episode. Just head over to the Parentpreneur Accelerator community on Facebook, where you'll find other parentpreneurs that are sharing their experiences and helping each other to succeed. To find the group, just visit parentpreneur.com/community. Thanks very much.